You're listening to Not Many of You Should Become Teachers, a podcast that explores the world of K-12 education as it intersects with the Christian faith. You might call us extreme moderates. We're skeptics who try not to be cynics and are allergic to cheap rhetoric. Welcome to the show. All right. We are here for another episode, Not Many of You Should Become Teachers, and we are joined with a very special guest this evening. We're recording after hours for this excellent interview that we're going to have. So, Dave, how about you introduce our guest?
Well, it's quite exciting to sit across the table from the former colleague and friend. We go a few years back now, and Adam Wolters, you played a role in me becoming a teacher, so grateful for that. And okay, so not just a friend of the podcast.
I think I had both of you guys as student teachers at one point.
I'm pretty sure. So.
And I hired one of you. I tried to hire the other one, but that didn't work.
Awesome. So a very warm welcome to you, Adam. And perhaps you could just tell us a little bit about what your current role is. I mean, it's kind of you've been in a whole bunch of different positions and. How did you wind up where you are now?
Cool. Well, I'm now head of school at Langley Christian. We have three campuses, just under 1,200 kids. Elementary, I should say, actually, we have pre-K as well. So four different streams or programs. One of the things that attracted me to this job is I'm all about community. Community is a core value of mine. And I'm really excited and really blessed to be able to work in an important job in my community. So I'm there now, and I came, my previous job was in the Langley School District. I was most recently a principal at R.C. Garnett Demonstration Elementary School, K-5. Prior to that was in educational leadership, IB coordinator at Pacific Academy out in Surrey, and did a stint in middle school there as well. Prior to that, a mix of international education as well as public. So I've kind of been in and out, which is, from what I understand, especially as an administrator, going back and forth between independent and public is pretty rare. But I see both of them really engaged in the same mission.
Mm-hmm. That's what I find fascinating, and it's quite compelling what you're up to, Adam. Just in terms of that fluency, like it's almost like being bilingual or speaking multiple, you know, wearing different hats. And one of the key things we've been doing on this podcast is thinking about faith and learning. And so there's a continuity line, I guess, there for you with your faith and Christian education, or the Christian faith interacting with education in various contexts. So. I know, based with your role in administration and in the classroom, you've given a lot of time to thinking about faith and about learning, and that's both within the classroom and beyond. So I wonder if you could just maybe spell out for us just some highlights for you, and we can certainly deep dive into some of them, but what have been some highlights for you or in your thinking around faith and learning?
A couple of things come to mind, and you may have to splice this up and edit this and make it sound coherent because I'm not sure it will, but a couple of things definitely come to mind. And one is the experience of an educator, both within the public system as well as the independent. I find there's a certain irony in the fact that when I've worked with in a consulting role, or a training role or an administrative teaching role in the independent Christian school system, I've found it at times harder to be a Christian than when I've been in the public system. There's, in some cases, these barriers or these expectations external to you in the Christian independent system that people put up around their expectations of what kind of Christian you are or what that looks like or how you teach in a particular way. There's also, at various times, I've seen a number of iterations of Christian worldview integration neatly packaged in some sort of workshop format where somebody comes in and gives you this silver bullet that you can integrate into any course. And every 10 years, there's kind of a new one. The Teaching for Transformation model is another one, most recently in the province of British Columbia. My understanding is that it comes externally from British Columbia, but that would be one that's very commonly found in a number of Christian schools now. And it's not that I'm cynical of these, but I see them as limited value. They have great potential as big ideas to think about where and when they fit. Possibly even replacing big ideas in our current curriculum. But beyond that, and this is the link to sort of another anecdotal story here, is at the end of the day, for me, it really comes about the who of the teacher, the who of the person who is in front of and amongst students. I've also had the opportunity of teaching students at Trinity Western University going through teacher training program. And the number of times was quite substantial for me and quite impactful, where I'd have students come to me after a couple of years, maybe I taught them in my previous school, they'd gone through teacher training, and they talked very passionately about the impact of a Christian teacher on their lives. And it had nothing to do with biblical world integration, had nothing to do with the content they were teaching. Riley, your dad would be one who, numerous stories of people on the Trinity Western campus who engaged with me about the impact of him on them. And it was always about how they carried out their faith in the classroom, how they modeled thinking through biblical lens, how they modeled thinking through criteria that was different from mainstream culture. How they modeled really wrestling with the messy and gritty struggles and problems of life. Those were the teachers. Those were the experiences that really impacted kids and their faith, not the biblical worldview integration models that we try to hang our hat on.
So having been in so many different scenarios and situations and wearing many different hats, one question that we're curious about is whether the approach that you've had to faith and learning or any approach that you've experienced, has it been affirmed or has it been challenged in your work as an administrator?
Yeah, I mean, tough question. I mean, that's a pretty deep one. I think if I've been challenged at all, it's been living in this tension that seems to exist in the independent Christian schools, between being a Christian school and being a really good school. And I joke quite regularly about being years and years ago at a Christian independent schools conference gathering of literally dozens and dozens of schools, and being challenged by the speaker, who said, "If you're not about excellence, if you're not about quality teaching, then take the word Christian right out of your school's name. Don't associate the name of Christ with anything mediocre." And that's sort of resonated with me. But there's, in a lot of the conversations that I have, both with parents, both with teachers, there's always this tension that if we become really, really, really good at teaching, that we somehow lose the Christian identity of our school. And I think that also highlights another tension between, which I think is a demographic and generational challenge as well, that I think is one that challenges administrators in Christian schools today. And that is the typical family that is now enrolling in Christian schools aren't necessarily the family that have this long-standing tradition, foundational, going back to the 1950s or 60s, whose families sacrificed, sold their farm, didn't have a car, whatever it was, to build the Christian school in their community. And that was, and it started in these church basements. And that was for 25 years or more of their life as parents, that was the focus of their life and their existence and their living, that and their church. And the families now that I see coming into a lot of Christian schools are coming in for completely different reasons, and a lot of them complex, and a lot of them, at the end of the day, not really the reasons that they might check off on a survey when we ask them, why did you come to Christian education? Functionally, they're there for a host of reasons. And a lot of times it's they're fleeing something, or there's something that they don't like about the other options in their community. And they want Christian education, but they also want a really safe school. They also want an excellent education for their kids. They also want opportunities for their kids. And it's not enough for them just to be a Christian school. They also want a quality experience for their kids. And there's a tension there that can be quite challenging. But I think also affirming, because at the end of the day, I see myself as an educator. I see myself as an educational leader. And I don't want to build a school experience that replicates the church or tries to fill some gap that churches and families aren't currently fulfilling, but should be fulfilling. If anything, we need to equip parents and churches better, partner with them better, but not try to fill a gap that people aren't getting elsewhere.
Yeah, I know we've had conversations here on this podcast, and Adam, I know we've had conversations in the past as well about that triad model of the home, the school, and the church, and where there's a deficiency in one, we can't be propping it up elsewhere, and we run into a whole bunch of problems. As an educational leader and somebody who's worn multiple hats, when we've been talking a lot about faith and learning and specifically like Christian pedagogy, that this idea of, are we, I'll put it another way, is there something distinctive about a Christian school, or is it a school that has teachers who happen to be Christian, or is there... is Christian pedagogy something that is more than just good or excellent pedagogy that happens to be taught by a Christian? You mentioned Irv Duick, Riley's dad, and sort of there's the relational and there's the teacher matters more than we often think. I'm just interested in where the teacher fits in with larger thinking about pedagogy.
I think pedagogy is really key for a number of reasons, and I'll come back to that. But first of all, pedagogy, teachers are not just simply technicians. And if we were, that in this age of a quote-unquote fourth industrial revolution, we'd be replaced very easy. I actually think that as we look to the future of Christian education, that it actually plays a more important role in the future of our society, the future of our communities, than it ever has before, if we think about it right. In a day and age of artificial intelligence, robotics, automation, the competitive advantage that kids coming out of schools is going to have is that they have a high degree of relational, emotional, social intelligence, that they know how to be in relation with people, that they know empathy, that they know love, they know what it means to be truly human and to exist in this this tension between faith and reality and disreality and artificiality that exists, you know, in the mere fact that we now live in a society where everybody carries around a recording studio and can create their own versions of their own reality. So it plays to be able to actually honestly question what is truth and what does it mean to be human in really truly authentic ways that examine over 2,000 years of human history and the biblical narrative. Like, that's really powerful, and there's no other place where you can actually do that. So that's, I think, a key, you know, that's a key piece of what it means, or what a Christian pedagogy looks like. I think also we have to remember that teaching by its very nature is a different occupation than some other professions. What it means to be a teacher of, I'll use the example of biology. What it means to be a teacher of biology is different than what it means to be a biologist. We we should be experts in how to design instruction, how to elicit thinking from people, how to assess, how to set really good learning goals that are appropriate to the individual, and how to give feedback on whether or not or how close students are to those. So all of that doesn't sound really unique to Christian schools, except for the fact that good pedagogy is aligned. It's congruent with how we know God designed us to be as humans and how to flourish and how to thrive. And so I see Christian pedagogy as really a pedagogy that's aligned with what we know about how to create the best possible learning experiences for kids. And so I don't see any tension between teaching really, really well using research-based practices and being a Christian teacher. The two should fit seamlessly and in fact complement each other. But at the end of the day, none of those practices are effective at all without existing in really sincere, loving, caring relationship with students.
And ultimately, like you, this doesn't sound idealistic, because you started at the beginning of the interview talking about you're sort of a bit of an allergy to some of the fads that come and go. Like that, you're describing something that's actually more bedrock. Like it has.
Well, I love what Dylan Williams says, who I think is one of the right now the most influential and probably most important voices in terms of what quality education looks like, whether it's Christian or non-Christian. And he says that, look, there's been nothing new invented in education in the last 2,000 years. What we know about good quality educational experiences is pretty simple stuff. And I like another term. I think it's Michael Fullan who uses the term simplicity. This is simple stuff, but it's hard to execute. In our school recently, through a number of processes and collaboration with our leadership teams, we've come up with 10 statements. It's a framework for teaching. It's what we call educating with impact. And it's every day, every child, every classroom in our school. It describes what we believe the experience should be like for every kid, no matter what grade, no matter what subject they're taking in our school. It answers the question, what does teaching and learning look like? What do you believe about teaching and learning in your school? And there's not a lot of Christianese in it. It's just solid instructional, really sort of simple concepts. Like, we build relationship and rapport with every kid. That's number one. That's right at the top. Those are simple things, but the complexity exists in how you implement them and ensuring they're being implemented consistently and in really effective ways that aren't artificial.
Something for me, just in case someone were to mishear, because you've said, and I love what you said, that basically that our good pedagogy is congruent with...
It's congruent with how God designed us.
With how God designed us to be. So I don't want someone to mishear and say that, well, like good teaching practice, some people might confuse that with what we heard earlier with excellence. So how do you maybe, not that there needs to be a line drawn, but I just want to make sure that we're not... overlapping a little bit, because I think you push back at that idea that we shouldn't...
I do a little bit. And okay. I'll give you sort of, again, I previous school I worked at, we talked a lot about being world class. And that was often talked about from our board. And that was the terminology we used. And we found out very quickly, especially being... globally connected educators who were working with teachers in Europe, working with teachers in other part of the world, visiting schools throughout the United States. We found out very quickly that there was a lot of what we did that was a very presumptuous thing for us to say about our school. It's okay as an aspiration, but I think you need to be... The one thing I've learned about goals, especially as a leader, is that goals or aspirations become almost meaningless cliche if you don't have some measurable indicators of how far along you are toward that aspiration with some sort of timeline. And so I don't have a problem with a school aspiring to excellence. In fact, it's a strategic priority of the board that I work with. It's a strategic priority that if it wasn't a strategic priority, I would not have accepted the job as head of school. It's something that's really important, but we need to define very carefully what excellence looks like. And for me, within schools, that's really easy. Statements like we want to be the best school, we want to be the best school in Canada, we want to be the best school in the West Coast, we want to be the best Christian school. Not only are those things really hard to define and quantify, but they also indicate this really deficit mentality of education. And the one thing I know about education is that deficit mentalities are not helpful. It's not a win-lose proposition. By becoming really good teachers, somebody doesn't lose. Other schools don't lose out because we become really, really good. It's really about win-win. It's about building capacity. It's about how can your school be a light on a hill for other schools? How can you build capacity in other schools? How can you share the good things that you're doing with other schools? How can you learn from other schools? How can we better the educational experience for all kids within a region? And so that's really what excellence looks like. And I think that's really a sort of a biblical model of excellence. It's building capacity. It's sharing the gospel. It's sharing good news. It's having impact. And that really is the word that I prefer to use when I talk about influence, because we need, or so we want to talk about excellence, is that excellence is knowing your impact as a teacher. It's knowing your impact as a school. What impact is your teaching actually having on kids? What impact is your school experience having on kids? What impact are your graduates having, serving in their community, being people of influence in your community? And if you have a measurable, demonstrable, visible impact, you're an excellent school. Yeah.
Adam, on this podcast, we ask our guests often what they're reading, whether it's for pleasure or professional development. We're constantly name dropping books and even running a little bit of a book club here. So, do you have anything on your bedside table or at your desk? What are you reading these days?
I'm reading all kinds of stuff, and the line for me, quite sadly, I think, it is very blurry between reading for pleasure and reading for professional development. I am a bit of a geek. You know, I've mentioned a big fan of Michael Fullan, and then Dylan William would be two people's books who I reread this summer as I prepared for this role. So I did a ton of reading. An author that I've recently discovered from my brother-in-law, who's a lawyer and in a leadership role in his law firm, he passed on the name of a writer named Patrick Lencioni to me. And he's a business writer, brings a Christian perspective to business. And he's written a couple of great books. One that I'm rereading, read another book called The Advantage this summer, which is about the competitive advantage that organizations with a real healthy culture of teamwork, the advantage that those organizations have. And I'm rereading Five Dysfunctions of a Team right now, which is just an excellent work. And just really, really good practical stuff in terms of how...
That's the one that's told like a parable almost.
Yeah, all of them, yeah, all of his books are written as parables, yes, and okay, fables. Yeah. And then he sort of unpacks them at the end. So they're good reads. You need to read them a few times. Sometimes it's better to read the end of the book and then go back and actually read the parable. fantastic reads. And one of the big takeaway for me for that book was and it maybe relates a little bit to sort of claims of being, again, being world-class school and that sort of thing. But, the arrogance or the dysfunction that can occur within a school system when you're inattentive to results. And, I think one of the sort of just thinking through one of the real challenges is that when you have success, it leads to some complacency. And then complacency eventually leads to failure. So just being really intentional about what you're measuring, how you're measuring success, what are your markers, and then being really attentive to those. And I've had numerous experiences as an educational leader where when we were attentive to very specific results, it resulted in a massive impact on kids' lives.
So thank you for that. I'm curious, is there anything else that that we did not cover that's on your heart that you feel like you want to share?
You kind of got at my, I guess, some of my my big rocks, the things that I've spent a lot of, ironically, that I've spent a lot of time thinking about in the recent months and weeks is it was a really hard role. I mean, I left independent Christian schools, felt really called to go back and work closely in my community, which it was just an awesome experience. 6 years as an administrator in Langley, working with the people and the families and the kids that I do life with or run into in the Home Depot. And so it was a bit of a tough transition for me to when this opportunity arose, and a school was in need of a strategic leader. It was something I really wrestled with, and I think I probably was the most emotional I've ever been in my last 2-3 days at RC Garnett. I think I cried pretty much nonstop anytime somebody came and talked to me. I was a blubbering mess. Really, really tough transition, but to see now the opportunities to have an impact in my community in a different way here is pretty cool. And looking forward to seeing what God does with this school in Langley.
Excellent. Just to wrap things up, is there a place where audience could go and find more about you, whether that's Twitter or other places online?
Well, I'm in a little bit of a different role now. So I filter a lot of stuff through the front page of I didn't delete everything, but I filter a lot of stuff through the front page of the newspaper test. How does this look on the front page of the newspaper test? But I also filter stuff, a lot of stuff now too, in terms of what sort of identity or what am I projecting through social media? And I think when you're in a leadership role, you got to be really careful about that. I think as a teacher, you got to be super careful about that. And I think not enough of us are. But what kind of identity am I shaping in the minds of other people? What kind of realities am I creating for people? Who has access to me? Who doesn't? Because it's an influential role. I don't want to create inequities around who is on social media, who's not. So in the absence of a really clear communication strategy from our school, I've been more careful in recent weeks before I developed that communication strategy around how I communicate via social media, what I put on social media. And so it's an area right now where I'm sort of exploring, but I do love Twitter. It's an awesome tool. Instagram has its uses. I'm sure if people Google me, they can find all kinds of cool stuff, including so really hilarious pictures.
It's like a let me answer your question with a question sort of answer. I love it. All right, Adam, thank you so much for coming. This was a very valuable interview, so thank you for coming.
Thank you.
This week's installment of our book club, we are reading The Graham Paradox, which is written by Ken Weitzma. Dave and I were talking the other day and we realized that we think it's pronounced Weitzma, but for all we know, it could be pronounced Witzma. My apologies, asking for forgiveness if I've been saying it wrong, but we're on chapter 3, which is entitled What Kierkegaard Knew. If you know anything about Kierkegaard, he was the one who made the leap of faith famous, the phrase leap of faith. So this chapter is about faith, and he starts by talking about how the word faith can be anemic and hollow in the American context. And I think that's a great way to start because that's 100% true. And what he does is he grabs another one of another difficult Bible story. Remember, we talked about Joshua, and that can be a difficult story to break down. But he talks about the testing of Abraham and the sacrifice of Isaac, and talking about Abrahamic faith and what that's supposed to look like. If you don't know the story, I think you can check it out in Genesis, 22 or 23. But it's just a very high stakes test in which the promised son, Isaac, is essentially commanded to be sacrificed by his own father. And Abraham needs to decide whether or not he's going to follow through or not. And obviously, or maybe not obviously, but you may know in the story that Isaac is replaced by a ram that is caught in a thicket nearby, and that ram becomes the sacrifice. To break down faith in this story, Ken Weitzma says that there's no morality or logic that Abraham can lean on to defend or explain to his wife or others about what he's going to do. God calling him to do something in faith that is completely unreasonable. I like to say it this way: true faith is ungrounded. The resolution isn't always apparent. Imagine trying to fly a magnet through the center of a metal pipe without letting it touch the sides. There is constant energy pulling the magnet towards one side or the other. To ground it on the side of the pipe, keeping the magnet in the center requires a lot of tension, energy, and effort. But if it slips just a little in one direction, it grounds on the pipe's wall, and suddenly the tension and difficulty are over. That's how Abraham must have felt, caught in the middle, completely in tension between what he knew God had asked of him and what he must have wanted to do. Moving on, Weitzma breaks down what faith, well, essentially what it's not. He talks about it not being a resignation and just giving up and suppressing our desires to become more spiritual, but it's following. It's not, resignation is quitting and faith is hoping. He mentions that it's not martyrdom, as martyrdom can be a way of acting through pride, which is not what he's looking for. And then finally talking about that faith is not just searching other voices or other Christian writers or people to give us a smarter brain in faith. And it's not imagination, where we can think of faith just being our own dreams and desires. He concludes that that faith, he has even a little equation, that trust plus obedience equals faith. And I think we were talking about trust in a previous chapter, which is a very important word. It's leaning in and trusting. And then it's manifested in obedience, which he uses the Abraham story to show. In a paragraph, he says, "What's the point? Faith is not mere resignation to obedience, simply doing what God asks. It doesn't believe that God has destined us to suffer. It does not covet wisdom from others or worship intellect. Faithful obedience is inseparable from the belief in God's trustworthiness that subsequently moves us to follow, trust, and obey Him. Faith is unconditionally trusting God and acting as He commands." Obviously, he caps off this chapter with a Kierkegaard piece of The Leap of Faith, and he talks about how it's been wrongly assumed to mean that belief in God is irrational. But Kierkegaard's point has much more to do with obedience to God when you don't have rational reasons or information to motivate the action. Nothing except a trust in the faithfulness of God. Americans have often had a mindset that bigger is better, but it's not about the size of the leap. It's about the leap itself. And I'll close with this quote: faith, true Abrahamic faith, takes the shape of obedience. And to that, I wholeheartedly agree. It's a very difficult passage, and there's many different readings, but I'm totally in with the idea that trust and faith equals obedience, or trust and obedience equals faith. Sorry, forgive my misspeaking. That is important. That's important that we understand that faith is not just an airy-fairy belief in God, but it's about that we take the leap. It's not about having a larger leap, but that we take it. So my question for this chapter has to do with doing what God wants, because that's what he's going into in the next chapter, is about how do we know what God is doing? How do we hear what God wants of us? And my question is that, is faith doing what God wants, or is it about shaping how we live, or is it maybe both? I would be very curious to hear the author's response to that, but then also to dialogue about that. What's faith meaning in your circles or in your classrooms? Is it more about, well, A, is it just about belief, which he kind of crushes in this chapter, which I agree. It's not just about that. It's about trust and obedience. And then is it about listening and just doing what God wants for your life? Or is it about knowing who God is, knowing what God wants, and then having that shape your life? That would be my question. Next episode, we'll go into chapter 4, which is called Wisdom's Folly. I hope you're enjoying this book club, and I hope you enjoyed our interview with Adam. If you're looking for more Not Many of You Should Become Teachers information, you can go to our website at notmanyofyou.com. You can follow us on Twitter at notmanyofyou, and you can give us a 5-star review on any app that you listen to podcasts, and share it with your friends if you can. So we appreciate all that, and we love making this content. I hope you have a wonderful time. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.